So if you'll call the case, please.
Cornwood Alcohol, BBVA Compass Investment Solutions, et al., versus Edward and Geneva Brooks. And may it please the court, Mr. Jeffrey Donald, the appellant, and Mr. Greg White, argue for the appellant.
Sorry. Jeff, you ready?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Jeff Novel. I am the will be speaking for the appellants today. Your Honors, this is a bread and butter arbitration case. A motion to compel arbitration that was filed by the appellants was improperly denied by the trial court, and for two reasons, the appellants should prevail on this appeal because the trial court abused its discretion. First of all, one of the key issues is the scope of this arbitration clause. The scope is quite broad, and every single one of the claims that have been brought by the appellees, the Brooks, fall within the scope of the arbitration clause. The second line of defense that's been presented by the Brooks is that the arbitration clause itself is unconscionable. Unfortunately for the Brooks, the evidence that they presented at the trial court is legally, it's just not sufficient. It doesn't comply with what is required under Texas case law in order to show that an arbitration clause is unconscionable. They put forth several reasons why they claim it's unconscionable, both procedural and substantive, but they don't get there on the evidence that was presented to the trial court. Now, with respect to the background facts on this case, it is simple. The Brooks opened an IRA account with Compass Bank, with BBVA Compass, and that brokerage account, or the IRA brokerage agreement, includes an arbitration clause. Unfortunately, after a few years down the road, there was an error made by the appellants, or by the Compass, and there was a disbursement made from that account in approximately the amount of $108,000. It went to the wrong Edward Brooks. Compass acknowledged that that was an error, and for a period of approximately 2 years after that error, was attempting to cooperate with the Brooks in order to have the funds reinstated in that account. Now, in the process of attempting to get the funds reinstated in the account, there were representations that were made, a settlement agreement and release was presented to the Brooks that they refused to sign because they did not like the language that was included in that agreement.
But in the meanwhile, Compass held their money and wouldn't give them access to their money, is that right?
The third party at the time, I believe, had the money, but Compass had fully intended to reimburse the account for the amount that had been disbursed out of it. But Compass did have control of the funds that were going to eventually make their way back into the account and which were later put into that account in the past 6 months. And because the Brooks were not pleased with the efforts that Compass made to resolve the situation, they filed this lawsuit. Notably, after they filed the lawsuit, they then proceeded to cancel their brokerage account. And after they filed the lawsuit, they've now claimed, in response to the motion to compel arbitration, that their claims involve several facts and circumstances that are not anticipated by the arbitration clause contained in the brokerage agreement, and that for that reason, the court should not have compelled arbitration. Now, the first of the two defenses goes to the scope of the arbitration clause. Brooks simply claimed that several of their claims fall outside that scope. They did, however, in the trial court, acknowledge that the breach of contract claim that they brought does fall within the scope of that arbitration clause. With respect to the other claims, what they've attempted to do and what they do in their briefing is mischaracterize the language that the arbitration clause contains. They want the court and wanted the trial court to believe that the arbitration clause only governed simply buying and selling securities. It didn't regard anything other than that particular activity. But the language in the arbitration clause itself relates to all controversies which may arise between Compass and the Brooks, and there's four pieces of the arbitration agreement. It's concerning the construction of the agreement, the performance or breach of the agreement, agreements related to the brokerage agreement, or any transaction involving securities and or the Brooks security account. So there are a host of activities that fall under the scope of this arbitration clause. Now, as the court is, I'm sure, is well aware, The scope of an arbitration clause is determined by looking at the factual allegations. The claims are not the key piece or part of the analysis of determining scope. It's the facts that are alleged by the Brooks. And the facts that they have alleged in their petition, and they filed four petitions, but the one that was active at the time of the motion to compel arbitration, I believe, was the second amended petition, it's very straightforward, and it's the facts that I've basically stated to the court, that an account was opened, funds were incorrectly disbursed, there was a dispute over how that was going to be resolved, and then the account was closed. They take issue with some of the representations in the release that was presented to the Brooks in the process of Compass trying to resolve the improper disbursement or incorrect disbursement. Now, with respect to the scope and the facts, if the facts alleged, and there's a very broad standard, if they touch on matters that are covered by, have a significant relationship to, are inextricably enmeshed with, or factually intertwined with the contract that contains the arbitration agreement, the claims, plain and simple, are arbitrable. Now, in this case, every single one of the claims that the Brooks have asserted against the appellants all are based on the existence of this arbitration agreement and the brokerage agreement that was entered into by the parties. But for the parties executing a brokerage agreement, there would not have been funds deposited with Compass, and there would have been none of the events that followed the creation of the IRA account.
May I ask a question? Does this document that creates the brokerage account also constitute the document that, well, the brokerage agreement, the account that sets up the... Is there another document that sets up the account is what I'm trying to ask.
I believe the brokerage agreement is the sole document that exists with respect to the relationship between the parties. Now, with respect to the scope, all doubts regarding the scope are to be resolved in favor of arbitration. And so, you know, as a preliminary matter, the Brooks have conceded that the breach of contract claim falls within the scope of the agreement. And as I started to say, with regard to the remaining claims, they've taken the two approaches. They state that the agreement itself only relates to the buying and selling securities. As I went through, that is inaccurate. There are other activities that are covered by the agreement. Now, the facts made the basis of the Brooks claims for, and they've asserted a number of claims, but the facts made the basis of their claims for theft, conversion, money hadn't received, negligence, gross negligence, breach of contract, and denial of deposit liability and breach of fiduciary duty and fraudulent transfer and misapplication of fiduciary property or property of a financial institution, every single one of those is premised on the existence of this brokerage agreement. If there wasn't that agreement in place, they wouldn't have a basis for all their claims. And every single one of those claims is based on the assertion that there was a wrongful disbursement out of the account. So they can't separate those claims from the brokerage agreement. They all touch on matters that are governed by the brokerage agreement and therefore are consumed by the arbitration clause. Now, with respect to, there's a few other claims that they've asserted, DTPA claim, a negligent misrepresentation claim, and negligent misrepresentation by an attorney as a separate misrepresentation claim, and then a fraud claim. What the Brooks have done in relation to those four different causes of action is they've drawn a bright line, and they've said that after the funds were disbursed from this IRA account, then somehow the brokerage agreement terminated. Where they've come up with that line of reasoning, I don't understand. It is not a part of the document of the brokerage agreement. Disbursement of the funds does not cause that agreement to terminate. But in any event, what the Brooks have said is that there's a line.
Don't they have to sign additional documents to get their money back? If the brokerage agreement is all that's necessary and controls everything, then why do they have to sign additional documents to get their money back?
The concerns from Compass and the other appellants were that by just simply depositing funds into an IRA account, there were potentially going to be tax consequences because $107,000 was just going to appear, or there was going to be a check cut by the appellants to go to that amount. And so, for accounting purposes, that was one of the concerns, that there was going to need to be some cooperation between the parties in order to facilitate the Brooks not having a negative tax consequence and other potential issues with just simply putting money back into the account. Now, with regard to the fraud and the misrepresentation claims, the line that was drawn is that, or the claim that the Brooks make is that the disbursement terminated the brokerage account and that they've asserted all these other claims during a period of time in which the brokerage account didn't exist or wasn't active, and they're based on representations or what they contend are misrepresentations that occurred after the disbursement. First of all, as I said, the brokerage account didn't terminate. It was still in effect, and the language of the brokerage agreement itself anticipates that the arbitration clause is going to apply down the road. It's not simply to facts that were known at the time that it was entered into. There were later known facts that could arise that could be subject to the arbitration agreement. Now, the other issue with their bright line that they try to draw is that the DTPA claim, the misrepresentation claims, and the fraud claim all, again, arise, the genesis for those claims is the brokerage agreement. But for the brokerage agreement, there would not be the representations and the subsequent attempt to enter into a release.
Don't you agree there has to be a line somewhere? I mean, you can't just, the law cannot be that just actions can continue on and on and on for years and years and years, and you can propose additional documents and try to negotiate different settlements, but somehow all that acts subsequent to the entry of the brokerage agreement, all that is encompassed within an arbitration agreement concerning transactions and breach of the agreement and performance of that initial agreement. I mean, at some point, there's got to be a line somewhere, so why not make that line?
Well, the line can't be drawn there and just say that the previous agreement terminated because the brokerage account was still active. And the Brooks later acknowledged that when, after they filed the petition in this lawsuit, they then, about approximately a month later, did take formal steps to terminate the brokerage agreement. So for the period of time relevant to the issues that were going on, the negotiations and the representations that are made the basis of these other four claims that I've talked about, the brokerage agreement was still absolutely in effect, and they've acknowledged that. So while I would agree in as a general proposition that it is a fact-specific determination as to when and how far an arbitration clause stretches, I think that goes really within to an analysis of scope and both temporal scope and with respect to what substantive claims may fall within an arbitration clause. Now, again, with respect to those claims that they're stating are based on representations and something other than the brokerage agreement, the arbitration clause, again, is very specific and broad enough to encompass the representations that they're claiming are at issue. The arbitration clause, again, states that all controversies which may arise between Compass and Brooks concerning the transaction involving the securities account, certainly attempts to reinstate the funds that were disbursed from their security account, are transactions involving the security account. Second prong, or one of the additional items covered by the arbitration agreement, is performance or breach of the agreement. Again, by attempting to reimburse funds into that IRA account, Compass and Pershing and the other accounts are attempting to perform under the terms of the brokerage agreement. And then finally, the arbitration clause specifically references agreements related to the securities agreement. And one of the principal contentions that the Brooks made is that Compass presented a settlement and release agreement as a condition of having the funds put back into the IRA account. Well, certainly that settlement and release agreement is an agreement that is related to the securities agreement.
Put back into the IRA account, so the funds aren't in the IRA account.
They are presently. There was, after the lawsuit has been filed in the past several months, funds, approximately $108,000, was deposited back into the IRA account, and then the separate payment, no strings attached, of about $100,000 was made to the Brooks to attempt to right the issue. Because there's an acknowledgement that the wrong Edward Brooks was a recipient of the funds, or somebody who had the power of attorney for a different Edward Brooks was the recipient of the funds. But
so now the issue is the loss of the use of those funds, or loss of interest and so forth, and the credit charges they had to, during the two-year period that they did not have the funds.
I believe that is, I think the Brooks would contend that is the issue, and that there's some other damages that they incurred. I believe from our perspective, from the appellant's perspective, it would be simply that there was a loss of use of funds, and that there is probably some growth that would have been attached to having those funds in the IRA account that should be.
These are pre-tax dollars.
Correct. Correct. Now, the other defense outside of scope that the Brooks have raised is that this was simply unconscionable, that because the way that the facts played out, there was procedural unconscionability and substantive unconscionability. Now, as I'm sure the court is aware, procedural unconscionability typically relates to circumstances surrounding the adoption of an arbitration provision. What the Brooks have instead said is that because of the way the facts played out, they could have never anticipated that funds would have been disbursed to a separate Edward Brooks, to an individual other than them, without their knowledge and without their authorization, and that because of that, somehow the arbitration agreement itself was procedurally unconscionable. That is simply not the law with respect to procedural unconscionability.
And are there any other questions?
No.
All right, can you wrap it up? Your time's up, please.
Your Honor, likewise, I would say with respect to substantive unconscionability that the there are specific requirements under Texas case law as to what evidence must be presented to show that an arbitration clause because of cost is substantively unconscionable. The affidavit of Geneva Brooks, which is their sole evidence on that issue, does not get there. It doesn't
Thank
compare
you.
The costs like it's supposed to. Thank you.
Thank you. You start talking, the light goes on.
May it please the court, my name is Greg White, and I represent Edward and Geneva Brooks. The appellant began the argument with, this is a bread and butter arbitration case. I don't think these facts are bread and butter in any respect. It is a rare, one would hope, occurrence that a broker would take your money and give it to someone else.
What evidence of unconscionability did you present?
There is a group of unconscionability facts. First of all, there is the affidavit of Ms. Geneva Brooks, and that appears in the record at, lost it. I'm sorry, 120 to 121. And Ms. Brooks says that by taking this money away, they can no longer afford to do anything. They're living off credit cards, and they've run up debts to pay their mortgage and their regular living expenses to the tune of $280,000 while waiting to try and get this money back. So that expense, I mean, we can know here, and a trial judge can know that litigation plus arbitration would be a heavy, heavy burden for someone in that financial straits. We also know, and the judge could know at trial, that parallel proceedings, and this one is, litigation amongst some parties and arbitration amongst others, according to Compass Bank, would be a double expense. Moreover, Ms. Brooks notes in her affidavit that there are different rules that would apply to the arbitration proceeding. By different rules, I mean that one party is subject to one set of arbitration rules, another party is set to another set of rules, and then we have the litigation parties subject to yet a third set of rules. Some of those impacted by what discovery would be permitted, what discovery would not be permitted. And then finally, we have with parallel proceedings a tremendous risk of inconsistent results. Now, having heard that evidence, the trial judge determined that he would deny a motion to compel arbitration. There are no findings of fact, no conclusions of law, but based on the trial court's decision to deny arbitration, the court must assume that the trial court found unconscionability. There is evidence to support it, and as the court is well aware, that when the standard of review is to defer to the factual determinations of the trial judge, even though the law questions, that is, how the contract says and everything else, is de novo review. So if the trial judge found, as a matter of fact, which we can presume that he did, that unconscionability was proven, and there's evidence to support it, then there is reason here for the court to affirm the trial court's ruling simply because unconscionability is one independent ground to decide that arbitration is inappropriate. Now, we always begin reading arbitration cases with that first sentence that says that the law favors arbitration. And it's probably good every once in a while to think about what that means because the law favors settlement, too, and cases say that over and over again. But the law doesn't require people to settle cases unless there is an agreement to settle cases. And the law doesn't require parties to arbitrate their disputes unless there is an agreement to arbitrate a dispute. If the court were to construe this overriding policy that the law favors arbitration to force Edward and Geneva Brooks to arbitrate here, the court would actually be ignoring very important competing policies. That is, that the rules of construction with respect to contracts are applied in arbitration agreements. That the right of the parties to contract as they might see fit applies to arbitration agreements, and that courts do not rewrite contracts for the parties. So we'll go to the exact language of this arbitration agreement, which says in the beginning that the purpose of this agreement is to appoint Compass, and I put that kind of in an umbrella, the entities on the other side here, to be our agent, not to enter into a deposit account where we'll debit and credit each other depending on what transactions we have, but to be our agent, to act on our behalf to purchase and sell securities. We will arbitrate, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but I'm getting this language right, we will arbitrate controversies concerning the construction, performance, or breach of the agreement, or transactions involving securities or the securities account. Now, the fact here that Compass took the Brooks's money and gave it to someone else is nowhere contemplated by the agreement that the parties entered into. Nobody figured that the agent that you had appointed, that your broker, would simply give your money to someone else. They didn't allow for a kind of a resolution in case we give your money away when we shouldn't. And if you wonder, well, couldn't they have written an arbitration agreement that would cover that instance? And you don't have to read many arbitration cases to say they're easy to write. Go pick out the Jim Walter Holmes arbitration agreement. Go pick out the Weekly Holmes arbitration agreement. And those say, we all agree that we'll arbitrate every controversy, every dispute, every claim of any type in court, tort, or contract arising under federal law, arising under administrative obligation, or arising under the contractual performance that's here. No one would contest that Compass Bank, again, the umbrella, is a group of very sophisticated business persons. And had they wanted to write an agency agreement where all matters of any type would be subject to arbitration, it would have been an easy agreement to write.
Well, can I ask you a question about the language here? Reading from the agreement in the middle of the arbitration provision, any transaction involving securities and or your securities account, how is that not broad enough to encompass they're taking money out of the account and giving it to someone else?
Well,
it's a transaction involving the account.
Well, not really, because they are our agent for purposes of trading in securities, not the, in a traditional bank account, Justice Gardner, I mean, I put my money in the bank, but I have an agreement with them that is, they are a debtor to me. That's our agreement. It's not that I gave them my money. They just owe me that money back. And so the debits and credits between parties are adjusted on a monthly basis. When
Isn't that true of the securities account also?
No, they are our agent. I gave them my money, and they deal on their account on my behalf. And so that's my money, not a debit and credit that is adjusted between me and my broker. So, and I say all that to say that when the arbitration agreement says that we will arbitrate disputes regarding securities, these are not the securities. This isn't a stock. This isn't a bond that they gave to Ms. Williams. That's the third party that they gave.
But it also says and or your securities account.
My securities account is the one that holds my stocks and bonds and other financial instruments that have a value that they are holding for me.
Or if all of the stocks and bonds are liquidated, then it would be cash in your account.
It would be in that instance, yes. But that's not what is going on here. I mean, giving the money off to someone else who does not belong to is not a trade in a securities account.
But it doesn't say that. It's not limited to that. It says any transaction involving securities and or your securities account.
Well,
I'm not seeing your line that you're drawing there.
Well, I'm drawing the line because let me just draw it broader, and it can either I recognize this is not a clear agreement for this set of facts. Nobody, as I said before, nobody contemplated that they would give their money to somebody else, so it's not dealt with in the agreement. But I think that's very important. Well, let me draw the line first, because that was your question.
Okay.
And I draw it because the parties never contemplated that the money would be given off to somebody else, and therefore the remedy that they are calling for is a typical broker remedy. That is, if you are dealing with Merrill Lynch or Edward Jones, then you say, if we don't like the way you dealt with our account and we're complaining about that, we will arbitrate in front of the NASD or someone like that. That's typical for brokers, and that's what they did here. But nobody said, and I'll tell you what, if something else worse happens, we'll also arbitrate that. They didn't think anything worse would happen because the purpose of the agreement was for the purchase sale of securities, meaning the stocks and bonds and other financial instruments.
I think your point is made by looking at paragraph number 10 of the Compass Brokerage Customer Agreement, which talks about transaction charges. And it's clear that a transaction says that your securities account shall be carried by the clearing firm on a fully undisclosed basis or fully disclosed basis, certain transactions and unit investments, trusts. I'm sorry, my copy's kind of small print.
As is mine.
But it appears that transaction, as used in this document, is looking like those kinds of transactions, not the closing or the payment of an account.
Well, I mean, even though Compass argues here that returning the money back to us is somehow performance of the agreement, or that attempting to settle with us by sending a release is somehow related to the brokerage agreement, I really think that a candid and honest review of the agreement says that nowhere in it does it contemplate what will happen if the money is handed off to someone it doesn't belong to. That's not performing the agreement. That's not breaching the agreement. That is, and this is where we go into this other area, it's really kind of an independent tort. And we've cited the court to the cases that say that torts are not generally arbitrable, but unless the arbitration agreement says so. But that falls from a wide body of law that we've all been through, the contorts cases that came back and forth. And we ended up with the Supreme Court giving us clear guidelines about how to distinguish tort cases from contract cases, tort claims from contract claims. There's that case, Delaney versus Southwestern Bell, Reed versus Jim Walter Holmes, Formosa Plastics. They all say that if the things you are complaining about arise only because you have a contract with that person, then it is a contract case. If that person owes you those duties independent of the contract, then it is a tort case. And someone who has your money as a bailee, as an agent, if they have any kind of your property, they owe you an independent duty to return it to you upon demand. Whether you had a specific contract with them, whether you had an agreement with them, or anything else, that relationship gives rise to the agreement apart from any contractual obligations. And if you read the brokerage agreement, it does not talk about how to return money, when to return money, what to do with money, because it presumes this common law relationship, which is when you ask for your money, it is your money, and I have to give it back to you. This court recognized that, and I'm going to, Justice Gardner, it was that Magellan versus New Hampshire case that went all back and forth, and I know that the parties cited to the February 14th version of that, and I know the court has recently reissued on that. But the court recognized, that opinion specifically says, that these reinsurance agreements just kind of invade every part of the relationship with the parties, and it's almost impossible to discern whether these tort claims are independent of that contract or not independent of that contract. That doesn't exist here. We don't have any problem understanding whether a party has an independent duty to return money or not. I'll do just a few of my last minutes talking about this conclusion argument that appears in the brief. That is, when they gave the money away to Ms. Williams, that's the third party, the contract came to an end. We don't have any obligations after that. There are no rights, duties, or benefits that exist under the Compass brokerage agreement after you've got no money with them anymore. You can make no orders of them. You can't call upon them to be your agent. There's no benefit flowing to Edwards and Geneva Brooks after all the money is gone. There's no performance to be demanded. There's no breach after that. The contract is at an end. So the things that happened after that, which are all in the briefing that's here, can't be a part of the agreement. I wanted to also say something about the settlement agreement that was sent. You'll find that in the record, clerk's record 111 to 113. It's basically a two-page agreement, and the argument that is made here is that that settlement agreement was proposed because Compass couldn't give the money back without considering the tax consequences to Mr. and Mrs. Brooks. You will search that two-page document in vain for any mention of the tax consequences that are being cured by the Brookses signing the settlement agreement. Instead, all you can discern from the settlement agreement is, if you agree not to sue us, we'll give you the money back that we gave to someone else. Unless there are questions.
Thank you.
I'll just briefly respond. I believe there's one case that was previously issued by this court. It's UBS Financial Services, Inc. v. Branton. And Justice Gardner, I know you were on the panel with that case, so you know, you're like familiar with it. But that, and as well as Magellan, I believe, go to the issues that are presented by these non-contractual claims, extra-contractual claims that have been asserted by the Brooks. In the UBS case, the parties were compelled to arbitrate because the causes of action that were asserted by the Brantons all arose out of the relationship between Branton and UBS that was encompassed within the scope of the arbitration provision. And that's exactly what we have here. The relationship between the Brooks and the appellants is all encompassed within the scope of the arbitration provision. But for that relationship that's created by that agreement, there would not be any of the transactions that took place in this lawsuit.
Including the tort claims.
Including the tort claims.
But and that, let me tell you my problem. I don't see anywhere in this agreement an ability to hold their account hostage until they agree to additional provisions. And I don't see how that is part of the agreement to allow you to hold their account hostage until they fall on their sword and agree to more things to protect Compass. Can you explain that to me?
That is, ultimately, the funds were reimbursed, reinstated into the account. But I think that is just a reflection of trying to figure out by the parties the best way to accomplish that goal. Compass knew that the funds had been disbursed in error, and I think if they had the opportunity to go back and do it again, they would probably try to reinstate the account in a more expeditious manner. Now, I certainly don't believe that you said that they're holding their funds hostage. That certainly was not the intent of the appellants in this case. Like I said, they were trying to figure out the best way to get the funds back to the
Brooks. Without getting sued.
Well, and that is, they did present a release to them. And as I had said, that release did fall within it. It was one of the agreements relating to the brokerage agreement. I don't think there's any other way to look at that release document, regardless of what you may think of the method with which it was presented. It is a subsequent agreement that it does relate to the brokerage agreement, just like all the representations that occurred after the disbursement under the account were related to the securities account. And
fall within that scope of the arbitration clause. Now, the appellees have asserted that the affidavit of Geneva Brooks was sufficient, was legally sufficient in order to show unconscionability, and that if there's any, even a scintilla of evidence to support unconscionability, that this appellate court cannot do anything. Well, the factual determinations generally must be deferred to, but the trial court has absolutely no discretion to improperly apply the legal standard of unconscionability. Here, there is not any evidence of unconscionability. The affidavit of Geneva Brooks does not state that they can no longer afford to do anything. It states that arbitration will be a significant burden on them. What that affidavit does not do is elaborate whether that means they can't pay or that there's certain claims that can't be brought, likely because that is not the fact or not the case. The key issue that must be addressed with respect to an unconscionability claim with respect to cost is a comparison of what it will cost to litigate versus what it will cost to arbitrate. That's from the Olshan case and has been reiterated in several cases since Olshan.
Their position is that they would have to do both.
There are several factors that they can offer, but the case law is very clear that the key factor that must be, and I'm sorry, I misunderstood. You said that their position is that they must do both.
They must arbitrate and litigate.
And there is nothing unusual about piecemeal litigation. And mm-hmm. So we've cited several cases in our reply brief that state that certain claims, and there are certain arbitration clauses that do have carve-outs for particular types mm-hmm. of claims. And so there's nothing unusual with regard to having separate litigation. But the one thing that they failed to do with regard to their claim is provide any sort of comparison or any sort of guidelines from which the court can find that there is an unconscionability based on cost. Ultimately, the relationship between the parties all goes back to this brokerage agreement, and like the Magellan case, like the UBS case, all of the claims and facts that are made the basis of those claims arise from that relationship, and thus they're all consumed within the arbitration clause.
I have a question. I'm going back to the account again. Looking back up in paragraph 2 of the brokerage agreement, it says that Mr. and Mrs. Brooks, or you, authorized Compass to apply to open a securities account for you with the clearing firm. Are there two accounts, one with Compass and one with the clearing firm?
There's one account. The clearing firm, I believe, carries out the transactions. So the funds are deposited into an IRA account with Compass, and the procedural or the process of carrying out the transactions is taken care of by the clearing firm. But there's not two separate accounts. There's one IRA account.
Who is the clearing firm?
It is Pershing.
And that brings me to my question, because in looking at the term transaction as it's used in the arbitration clause in the party's agreement, clearly the breach of contract is covered by the arbitration agreement, and everyone concedes that. So the question is whether or not the other claims asserted fall within the scope of this particular arbitration agreement. And the language used in the arbitration agreement says concerning the construction, performance, breach of contract, and agreements related, so those are out, or any transaction involving securities and or your securities account. And so when we look at that word transaction, the other place that it is used in the party's agreement, the Compass Brokerage Customer Agreement, is in paragraph 10. And just as you were speaking, Pershing is the one who carries out the transactions, and it appears like transactions is intended to mean the purchase of stock. I mean, transaction charges in paragraph 10 are associated with the purchases of stock, or as I'm like I'm saying, that writing's pretty little for me up here, but it looks like it's executed, cleared, certain transactions in unit investment trusts, mutual funds, and other securities may be executed and cleared by Compass subject to the terms hereof. So that's my question, is if you say that the transaction as used in this agreement means stock transactions, then this arbitration provision is not as broad as the one that you rely on and cite specifically, financial services versus Branton, because this arbitration provision is limited to construction, performance, or transaction involving securities and or your securities account, taking out the language we agree to. And Branton says any and all controversies which may arise between the parties herein and the firm concerning an account, a dispute. So that's my question, is isn't there, where do you see the tort claims falling under, which specific clause? Is it performance, related to the performance of the agreement? Is it related to the construction of the agreement, or is it a transaction?
Well, it's...
Are they pulled within this arbitration provision under which particular clause?
I think there's overlap as to where the tort claims lie. One of the main bases on which the tort claims are based is that Compass made misrepresentations to us and made statements, committed fraud by presenting this release agreement to us. And that, as I'd say, is a separate agreement,
right,
that is related to the brokerage account. So I think it can fall under that particular provision. Separately, it is related to the performance of this account. If what they're saying is that by transferring or disbursing funds to this other individual, you've breached your agreement, any attempt to remedy that is trying to correct performance of the account under the brokerage agreement. So I think there's overlap as to where a transaction lies. And I think in other portions of the Compass brokerage agreement, Compass is authorized not only to carry out transactions, but also to carry the account and to take steps necessary to carry the account. And so I think it's broader than just saying there's, you know, a transaction is the only aspect of the agreement to which the arbitration clause applies. There's other activities that it applies to, including subsequent agreements.
Questions?
No.
Thank you. Well, y'all have come from quite a distance, and we appreciate your being here. The argument has been very helpful to us. We appreciate that. We appreciate the good briefs. Your case is submitted. And now you're free to go about your business, and this court will be, I guess we'll be in recess until 1:30. So.